This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Blank Podcast, the podcast where we talk to well-known guests about their lives, their careers and navigating those difficult moments along the way. I'm Giles Poley-Phillips and with me is Jim Daly.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, how are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you. Yeah, the sun's shining. I mean, my hay fever's trying to take me down, but apart from that, nothing else can take me down, man.
There's always something that's trying to take you down, Jim.
I know. Hay fever. I don't know if any of our listeners have hay fever. It's particularly bad at the moment. So my heart goes out to anyone that is suffering. But apart from that, you know what? I'm feeling pretty good. It's nice having the sun shining and the birds in the sky. And weirdly, ducks on our roof. For some reason, we got in our new extension, got skylights and water sort of pools a bit, which I think is more of an indication of the builders than us. But the ducks like to sit in it. So every morning we look up and there's like ducks in the sky. Sounds like a Beatles song.
Yeah, it does a little bit. Have you got names for them? Have you named them? Is it the same ducks every time?
They're just Mr. and Mrs. Duck at the moment.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if they're the same ducks. I assume they are. Very formal, yeah. I assume they're the same ducks. But, yeah, they're okay, though. We know, we're cool with them. It's all good.
Yeah, I think ducks are cool, though.
I think ducks are quite cool, actually. Hmm. Yeah. I agree. I would say one of the most underrated animals.
Yeah, I was going to say they're underrated. Mm. I love, because obviously I live by the coast, so we get a lot of seagulls who are not great.
Awful animals. Yeah. You go ducks over seagulls anytime.
Oh, massively. I take pigeons over seagulls, mate.
They weren't called the Mighty Seagulls, were they?
No.
That would have been a terrible movie.
No. The Mighty Seagulls.
That'd been awful. Mm. So there you go. Anyway, shout out to the ducks in the world. How are you doing? How's your week been? How's your 2 weeks been? Because this is obviously we had Easter off, so we're back.
Mm. Yeah, it's been good. I am now the parent of a 16-year-old, which is very bizarre. so yeah, my son turned 16. My oldest turned 16 this last week. So yeah, that's kind of strange. Mm. Made me feel very strange. Ancient. fully embracing my grey hair and curmudgeonly ways.
Well, you make both those things work. So,
thank you.
I think getting older is cool. I'm totally embraced getting older. I think it's great.
It's interesting. I watched a thing the other day. It was a video of a guy talking. I can't remember who the guy was, but he was some sort of psychologist or something. But he was talking about the various periods of our life and how the difficulty levels of it. So you get like sort of, you know, your teen to 25 kind of period where you're kind of learning and doing all your learning part and then finding like a career perhaps and then all working out that or going to university, all that kind of stuff. Maybe having, you know, a few like relationships and then, you know, going out and exploring the world a bit.
Like and then, the beta phase.
Yeah. And then 25 to 45, he said, is like the kind of really difficult period because you obviously get work and then you might settle down, which is obviously very nice, but then you have children and stuff and you're working really hard all the time and you've not got enough money and it's stressful and all that kind of stuff. It's quite a stressful period of your life. And then he said sort of 45 onwards or maybe even just early 50s, it starts to settle down again and... You know, he said, ironically, obviously the happiest people are often, you know, are older people. And obviously they're coming to the kind of, you know, you start to think about your own mortality and all that kind of stuff. And you're a bit more risk averse and all that kind of things like that. So it's quite interesting. So I feel like I'm hopefully now entering into that phase.
So I've still got 6 years left.
Yeah, you're a while off, mate.
I'm well in it.
But yeah, because you've got young children, you see. So you are well in it. So no sleep, worried about finances, all that kind of stuff. You're still, I mean, I'm not saying I'm not in that as well, but yeah.
Well, That's quite good to know, actually, that I've done that. That might, you know, there's an end game in sight.
It's quite reassuring.
That's good. That's good. I like to be reassured. That's I agree with most of that, actually. And the nice thing about getting older is you become friends with ducks from your roof.
So, exactly.
You know, it all goes full circle.
Could be early onset Alzheimer's.
Could be. Yeah. Well, maybe the ducks aren't even there.
Yeah.
I'm the only one seeing the ducks. Anyway, should we talk about this week's guest?
We should, really. Because as usual, we're talking crap.
We've not given them the best intro, but it is a fantastic guest. It's the fantastic Elizabeth McCafferty. What a fantastic guest she was. Multi-talented and just a lovely, lovely guest. So we had a blast, didn't we?
We did. We talked about all sorts of stuff, going from like her strange customised phone case through to talking about her acting and how she got into acting and going through a period of doing body doubling on film sets and stuff, and how that kind of gave her an insight into like working on films and to sort of taking that path as opposed to the sort of more traditional kind of drama school path. But you know, obviously she's been in proper productions and stuff, acting and doing solid roles, and then obviously the journalism stuff that she's doing and writing for lots of major newspapers and magazines and online outlets on all sorts of weird and wonderful kind of stories, which was very fascinating. You know, she spent a month in a monastery learning about how nuns live and talking to people. Like, there was a lady who hadn't burped for 20 years or something. So all sorts of random stuff, which is fascinating. And I think that's kind of where she sort of sees, you know, obviously she's still doing the acting stuff, but kind of sees herself as maybe going into documentarianism and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, really, really interesting. If you're into sort of weird and wacky stories, then she is definitely someone you want to follow, because she seeks out those kind of things. And actually her story of how she got into that is very interesting, sort of during lockdown, the first moving into the sort of Vice style stories is really good. So yeah, but also, you know, really accomplished actor as well, and just a real advocate for doing your own thing and sort of ploughing on and making things happen. I think she's very much someone that sort of makes things happen for herself, which is a real life skill. So yeah, absolute pleasure having her on, and I think people are going to really, really like this one, especially if you want to know how much your feet would sell on the black web. That's later on. But she's brilliant. Should we get into it?
I think we should.
This is the fantastic Elizabeth McCafferty. This is the fantastic Elizabeth McCafferty on the Blank Podcast.
Like it's got bits of icing on it.
Yeah, it's really embarrassing. It's the tackiest thing I own, but I made it in Korea.
It's amazing.
They've got like they've got cafes where you can just go and make kind of weird stuff, and that was quite up my street, so I went and made it.
So well, you've got Hello Kitty on there. Who else have you got on there?
Hello Kitty.
Not Hello Kitty.
It's Miffy. This is a character
Miffy, that's what I'm thinking of.
Called Pooka, and I used to collect this character when I was about 6-7 all the way up until I was about 12, and she kind of just disappeared off the face of the earth, and then I went in this weird cafe and they just had her, so I was like, right, that's going on
Pooka.
There
So what's Pooka? Is Pooka, was it a cartoon or something? I've never heard of Pooka.
Yeah, it was, she's like a cartoon sort of character, and it was sort of like Hello Kitty, but she's just called Pooka, and she was just on bags. You could buy little caricatures, like literally everything that you could, anything your heart desired of Pooka, you could get it. Like packaging, drinks cartons. So that was quite funny to see it after all those years. I kind of forgot about her. And then there's some Haribo.
That's amazing. I'd love to go and create my own like case for my phone.
Yeah.
What did you put on yours, Jim?
Well, I've got a very boring... Mine's just black.
Mine's so boring, like it's dull. Black, yeah.
I now feel really boring.
It feels very masculine, this.
I'd it's much like one of those... have a decorated one.
Well, I think, like, you know when you get a phone and, like, you look for the ones that says, like, hard shell or, like, armour.
Because I keep dropping
armour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've got the screen protector thing as well because I keep.
Oh, blimey!
You've gone. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't got that on in mine.
This is the thing. I think if I dropped mine now, it's so foamy that it would just bounce, and I'd probably lose it anyway because it would just ping off somewhere. So you know,
I'm trying to think what I'd put on. Yeah, I'm trying to think what I'd put on mine if I had that. I'll have to think about that over the.
What TV? What TV? And this is already a great tangent to start the podcast off. What TV episodes, Charles? Or TV shows from I'll get the words out, Jim. From your childhood, would you put on there?
Well, I'm just trying to think about that because that I guess if we're going to go down that theme, so I'm a 90s kind
of. So I know mine because I had a birthday cake. My mum made a birthday cake of this TV show when I was a kid, which is Danger Mouse.
Oh, yeah.
So I definitely have a Danger Mouse on there. Yeah,
not Penfold.
No. No one's picking Penfold. He's the least cool character ever on TV. Bless him. Obviously vital to the, you know, solving the cases. But
he was the brains of the operation.
Yeah, quite the brains, but it wasn't cool. Yeah. It wasn't cool. No.
No, true. What I got? God, probably like He-Man or something.
Wow.
That's way too masculine.
I was about to say, I wouldn't have had you down as a He-Man person, but, well, you surprise me every day, Charles.
Yeah, no, I don't know where that's come from, actually. I don't know if I would have He-Man on it.
If this is a different episode, just you and me, I would bury down into that. But it's not about us, Charles.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpick there, isn't there? Okay, well, let's not think about that. Well, I was going to start our conversation by asking, like, because obviously, Elizabeth, you do lots of different things. I do lots of different things. Jim, you do lots of different things. As creatives now, we are having to do lots of different things. And I was wondering... I often, like, if you go and meet new people, they're always like, oh, what do you do? And you're like, well, I do a bit of this. It's very difficult to explain what you do. And I wondered, what do you do in those situations? How do you explain what you do?
Yeah, I kind of find the same thing. I think the difficulty with sometimes being freelance is that I will become that person who just does whatever I can possibly do for cash. Where, you know...
100%.
within reason.
Depends how it's been going.
Yeah. I mean, I'm writing an article at the moment about trying to sell pictures of my feet. So technically, yeah, there's a lot of things where I've kind of entered different realms and sometimes got myself quite quickly back out of them. But I normally just say I'm an actor and writer because acting's where it all began and the writing came a bit later. But I definitely would just say I'm both now because I'm so absorbed in both worlds. If I'm not doing both, I'll miss it. So that's normally what I say. I love photography as well. That's something I kind of delve into. There's a lot of other things, but I probably wouldn't ever say that that's my sort of opening line job.
Yeah, I'm very much the same and I never know what to say. And I saw a thing on Twitter literally yesterday where someone had done some sort of joke tweet and they'd put... everyone asks me what I do. I just say, hard to say, and then just don't follow up. And just, I just leave it hanging there. Well, it was something
I
like
might
that.
Take that
like,
one.
Oh, I'm definitely going to do that next time. Say, it's really hard to say.
And then just don't say anything.
And also make it, I do like kind of like mysterious look at them. You know, like,
or into the distance, stare off into the distance. Like, well, yeah. I mean, who's to say, really?
Yeah, sometimes I'll say, depend on the day, you know. What day is it? That, you know, that can depend as well. But yeah, I'm very much on the same path. It depends who you're talking to as well.
Sometimes. Yeah, it depends how much energy you've got to try and explain it.
Exactly.
Well, I find that I start to explain it and the person just glazes over. And then you think, should I carry on? Oh, I'm kind of in it now.
I'm onto my fourth freelance job now.
I'm just going to caveat this with this. And I do this as well. And then the person, you can see the person's like, I really wish I hadn't asked what they do for a living. I mean, maybe that's like, it's a bit of a, I don't know if it's a British thing. I don't know if you find it in other cultures, like people, it seems to be like the go-to kind of question if you're meeting someone for the first time. First, it's the weather. Then what do you do for a living?
My biggest thing I find is that when I say I'm an actor who does something else, the first thing people either say out loud, if they're brave enough, or just, you know, they're assuming is an actor who isn't doing well enough to just be an actor. That is the go-to where they're like, oh, so you do a lot of things to subsidize the fact that you can't just act. And you can just tell that, and some people do just say it, and they'll just go, oh, really? And you work in a restaurant as well, I presume. Or they'll get the other side of it, and they'll go, oh, right, so how come you do the other things? Why, you know, why aren't you just acting and all of this stuff? And that's where it gets into a complete rabbit hole.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a bit, it's quite brutal, isn't it, when you have those kind of moments of like, it was the same when I was like doing music and stuff, and then people knew that I did other kind of part-time jobs, and it is like to say, it's like kind of subsidize your inverted commas hobby, which is what people kind of foresee it as. You're like, well, no, you know, I think it's that thing, there's a bit in The Office, isn't there, where Dawn says, I used to say I was an illustrator that did a bit of reception work, but now I'm a receptionist who does a bit of illustration. And it's like, you can go down those kind of routes with it.
Yeah.
But I think try as hard as you can to stay true to the creative thing that you do, rather than saying I do this, that and the other.
I think so. I mean, I used to really curse when I kind of would say, oh, I'm an actor and I do a bit of this and I do a bit of that or whatever. And now I just think, do you know what? I don't need to justify that. Yeah. I just need to own that, and it's just not really anyone else's business. And also, I'm actually really proud and happy at the fact that I got into writing, because I only got into writing because the acting wasn't working out as well. But I'm so glad I've done it now. So actually, it's a really positive thing to come out of that. And I'm just trying to own it a little bit more than kind of thinking, oh, people are going to judge me for not just being an actor.
Yeah.
But it's not to do anything to do with them.
It's not quite. And like, I would always be doing it apologetically, like apologizing to me, oh, I'm a comedian. And I think, well, you're giving them the vibe already. Whereas I think a lot of the time it comes down to people not understanding the industry, not understanding that literally 99% of actors are doing other stuff on the side. It is probably even less than 1% that are able to do full time. Same in comedy, same in music, same in most creative industries. And I think as well, possibly it comes down to a little bit of jealousy sometimes, that like, oh, so you followed your dream, did you? Oh, and you're making your dream work. Well, fuck you.
Yeah, exactly.
I think a lot of people don't, for whatever reason, some can't, some don't have the opportunity, some didn't want to, whatever. But I wonder sometimes it's just a bit of like, oh, right, okay, so you're nearly 40 and you're still doing your dream. How fucking dare you?
That's the thing. And also, actually, the more self-deprecating I was with it, the more people would sort of do it back. Do you know what I mean? So the more self-deprecating I was about myself. So sometimes I used to do the classic, oh, well, if you have to ask, you obviously don't know who I am. I'm an actor. Like, funny, you don't know who I am or whatever. Yeah. And actually now, and then sort of people would laugh and be like, oh, yeah, so what restaurant do you work in? And they'd sort of join in with that. And now, actually, when I've stopped doing that whole self-deprecating thing, people sort of naturally just respect you a little bit more.
Completely.
Which, you know, it makes my life a little bit easier. Makes my self-esteem a bit easier to just own it.
Yeah,
so.
Completely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like you say, own that thing. So let's talk about the acting then. So when did you get into acting? Was that at a young age?
Yeah, I hate saying this, it sounds so wanky, but I genuinely always wanted to be an actor ever since I was about 8. Very, very kind of adamantly said I was going to be an actor. Couldn't get into drama school. That, honestly, that whole process just couldn't do it. I'd get to recalls and final stages or whatever, and just never ever got in. And then I did National Youth Theatre, and I got picked up from that by, well, I was very lucky. I ended up having 10 agents pull me in, which was insane, because it was sort of like the girl who couldn't get into drama school and then suddenly all of this kind of stuff came in off the back of this one play that I did with National Youth Theatre. But I didn't get my agent until I think I was 23, so it did take me quite a while, but I was never not acting. I was always doing something, basically, from sort of since I was at school, leaving school. I was always doing plays and stuff like that. But I actually started off as a body double before I even got my acting agent. So I was being basically actors' backs and actors' hands and stuff like that for film sets if they, you know, weren't needed fully for the day. So that's sort of where I did a lot of my kind of training and learning about the industry and learning what it is to be on a film set. And then I got my agent. So I kind of went a very weird path about it. But I always just knew it was something I wanted to do.
Yeah, and I think paths are an interesting thing, because I think you, especially growing up, you have this idea of like, well, I'm going to do this, I'm going to get this, I'm going to get this, and it might not go that way. And sometimes things come to people like maybe a bit later on, or some people get it too early, or, you know, sometimes things find you when they're sort of meant to. But I guess at that age, it is quite hard to kind of get your head around that.
Yeah, and it's just so competitive as well. I think there's nothing that can prepare you for how savage the industry is. And when you're about 17, 18, and you're just thrown into this really quite scary sort of world where people aren't afraid of telling you what they think of you, for one, that's quite an intense thing. And people aren't afraid to make comments on your looks and things like that. And I think nothing could have prepared me for that. And I think because I maybe didn't go through that drama school route, I didn't have that 3 years of seeing the same people and being in a room and being having a teacher. So a lot of my training, as it were, was trial and error and just sheer brutalness of what the industry was. And I'm very glad I did have that experience, but there was a lot of me for a long time that was quite gutted that I didn't have that classic drama school experience where it maybe wasn't so scary and intense. And but that's something I can't change, and I think that's just something I've adapted to. But I very much did feel like I was thrown into quite a intense environment when I was quite young, being you know, on these massive film sets, being celebrities' backs and stuff like this. It was quite a weird kind of way to go from school to suddenly being in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And really, yeah, like you say, quite intense. Yeah. And I imagine, like, kind of just being on a film set, like a big, well, I mean, I guess, you know, fairly big budget kind of stuff.
Yep.
That's pretty full on as well. And like, just seeing how the apparatus of putting a film together is pretty mad. It's quite a mad industry from my little bit of experience.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's everyone's, you know, most people there at the time, you know, they'd been doing this for years and years and years, and you're trying to not let on how green you are while also kind of probably making some very green mistakes and stuff like that. So it was an amazing learning curve, though. I don't regret it for a second, but it was definitely a weird route, I feel. The start of my career was a very unusual route. I don't know many people who've sort of done that as well as an actor.
Yeah, no, I don't think many would. I think most would have gone the other route. But I think it clearly shows that you have a resilience in there, because I think a lot of people would have maybe found that too overwhelming, too intense, like too scary. But clearly you've got, and I think most creatives have this, that keep going, have a resilience in there that maybe you don't even know you have until you look back and you think, oh my God, I was really resilient at that at quite a frightening time.
Yeah, I think you've got to be slightly ballsy on a film set. I mean, so many people might completely disagree with me and be like, what on earth she's talking about? But there's a certain element of you have to hold your own, because, yeah. Well, especially as a, you know, in that position, you're not, I wasn't being sent by an agent. I wasn't an actor who's looked after and put in a trailer. It was it's very much, you're just thrown into set. You don't know what any of these big words are. You're given a radio and they're saying stuff and you're like, I don't know if they're talking to me or someone else. And it's very like no one's holding your hand at all, where arguably when you're an actor, you're picked up from your trailer. You're given a cup of tea and a blanket after you say like a couple of lines or whatever. And you are very shielded. And I feel like I could say that now because I've done the acting as well. But seeing both sides of it, you realise quite how looked after and protected and cushioned actors are in comparison. So in a way, when I did get my first actual acting job where I had lines, I was like, fucking hell, we are looked after. Like, did not realize how cushy it was, which was actually weird to adapt to as well.
Yeah. Well, you suddenly become, I'm doing inverted commas again, the talent. So there's that sort of, there's a need to like kind of look after you and nurture you a little bit more, I suppose, than if you're just someone on set who's kind of doing a job.
But I mean, some actors, I was just going to say, some actors think, you know, they're being
looked after and whatever because they're special and they're being given a blanket and a thing because they're this amazing star. But most often it is just because people are trying to keep them happy so that they don't walk off the set and waste loads of money off the budget. And actually, so yeah. I feel like I've seen exactly. both sides to that as well. Or, you know, someone's given an umbrella and the actors are like, no, don't worry. Like, I don't need an umbrella. I'm, you know, such a humble person. But actually it's just the producers being like, don't fucking ruin that costume in the rain. Like, yeah, you know, that is like, yeah, exactly. So I'm glad as well I've seen both of that side because it has kept me more, I'd like to think I'd always been very humble, but it definitely has kept me more humble as an actor because I've seen the clocks yeah. working from all aspects, yeah. which is quite
and
nice.
Yeah, and you could appreciate, well, and you sorry, could, Charles, what yeah. everyone's trying to achieve the same thing and you become yeah. part a cog in that system rather than like a wrench in the system.
Yeah, 100%. And even like stuff, sometimes I've seen actors literally going up to a grip, which they kind of build the track and stuff like that, going up to a grip being like, oh, I need this. And like, you just, that's just not their job. So yeah, even yeah. just being able to tell who is who on a film set. So if I need something, I can say,
yeah,
right, I know exactly who I'm going to. I quite like knowing that, if yeah. you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that I mean, I've learned yeah. that.
Yeah, because I'm not that I've ever been on a film set, but I can just imagine it's just chaos, right?
Yeah, and actually the...
Organised chaos.
Yeah, it is. And I think the difference actually is that very often they take actors to the trailer or whatever so that they don't see the chaos. And I think that... quite often you'll have a runner or a third AD or whatever, and they are probably having the shittest day of their life. But then to the actors, their smiles and looking after them and stuff like that. Yeah. And actually you kind of, if you haven't seen all of that, it's quite hard to imagine the chaos that they've gone through with the day, but it's actually quite often people will be having a really shit day themselves, but they're like trying to look after the actors and all of this stuff. But in a lot of ways, you know, actors have, Not in any way saying an actor's job is easy, but they have they're in a nice warm trailer and given heated blankets and stuff like this. And I've worked on jobs as a body double where we've been in like minus temperatures on beaches in the rain, no tents for crew or anything like that, and it's only the actors who've been given hot water bottles and warm drinks. And we were told you can't make a cup of tea because we don't have enough hot water. You can't have a hot water bottle because we don't have enough hot water. And then you see an actor walking around.
Tom Cruise has got yeah, all of it in his...
Exactly. And you see an actor walking around with four hot water bottles and a blanket, but then like they can't share it. So actually, in a lot of ways, it's just... I'm just so glad I've witnessed that because the actors in the tent, they can't see that everyone's freezing cold and not able to have a drink. Like they just don't... I just sometimes don't think actors know. That's a thing.
No.
Yeah.
No, and I can imagine if you. Well, I sort of use Tom Cruise as an actor that's quite famous. But I mean, it must be difficult. I mean, it must be weird for those kind of actors. They must be so unaware of what it's really like to work in the industry in some ways, because it's just like, I guess, yeah, they're just sort of looked after like royalty almost.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I was quite shocked, I think. Being on both sides, I was quite shocked either way. And I don't think that's a side that most people would see. Most crew would never be talent because they've obviously chosen to be crew. Yeah. They don't want to be talent and vice versa. So, yeah, it's interesting to observe.
can you tell us whose bodies or hands you were in any films?
Gosh, so I've been Keira Knightley's, I've been Lily Collins, I've been Leslie Mann, I've been...
Wow.
God, quite a few people. Trying to remember names. I've been Elodie Young. I've been... It's just so bad, I can't remember her name. She's in 13 Reasons Why.
I've not seen that.
Ashley Benson?
No. It's...
She's not in it. Ashley Benson's not even in that programme. Catherine Langford.
Yes, I've been her.
Yes.
I was Eva Green's double for some costume stuff with Tim Burton. That was very cool.
Wow.
I've done quite a few different people now. So it's yeah. fun. It's really fun.
Was there a particular hand that you were most pleased to be?
I think for kudos, you saying you're being Keira Knightley's back is pretty cool.
Yeah.
but, you know, I've enjoyed everyone. It's all been completely different as well. Different eras and all of this stuff. So it's quite nice. But weirdly, it's just not something I talk about in the acting industry because I was always told, well, no one gives a shit if you were Keira Knightley's back. If you're an actor, we just care about your face or whatever. And actually, I'm like, well, I think that's quite cool to talk about, but just no one cares about it. I actually kind of sometimes forget, even today, didn't even think I was going to talk about body doubling because just no one normally cares about it in my industry. So it's actually quite nice to be able to talk about it.
Well, and also the fact that you've taken this different route in, you know, like you haven't done the classical training through the drama schools and whatever, but you're, you know, you're able to be working as an actress in the industry through, you know, from that route. So that's, I think, all power to you for like, you know, going that, you know, doing that and putting yourself out there and like you say, your training, as it were.
Yeah, I think so. I've always loved screen and it's definitely solidified a lot for me as well because a lot of actors maybe when they're starting out might start in theatre and stuff like that and it might be a few years before you've had an experience on a film set. So for me, it very much solidified that's where I wanted to be. I just wanted to be on the other side.
That's interesting as well because, there is obviously like the actors love to be on stage, you know, the live performance and stuff. But actually, there is something to be said for screen acting. And it's obviously, I guess, a very different type of performance that you have to give.
Yeah, definitely. I did a lot of drama workshops when I sort of was starting out as well. So I'd always go to weekly classes or sometimes a sort of actor-y person would give a guest workshop or a casting director would and all of this stuff. And I do remember when I was 18, this kind of semi-famous actor, I was my first ever time acting on camera. I'd always done all the theatre stuff and they were like, right, we're going to do a mock audition, get in front of the camera and all of this stuff. And I did my audition. We all watch it on the big screen. And I was like, fucking hell, that is awful. I'm never going to be an actor. And I remember putting my hand up and saying, I've only ever done theatre. Do you have any advice for how you sort of transfer the skills into screen without being too animated? Because the thing is, I'm quite an animated person anyway. So I know I've got to turn it down about 100 when I'm on screen. And even like about 40 when I'm on stage because I'm so big normally. But I said to him, how do you kind of hone in those skills so that you look right on screen? Which I think is a valid question from an 18-year-old who hasn't been on screen before. But I remember he looked at me and went, well, Elizabeth, some people are born to be screen actors and, you know, they just have it. And some people don't have it. And I think you're just one of these people who just don't have it.
Oh, my God.
And I just remember being, like, 18 and being like, this is fucking horrendous. And now I'm like, you know, now I'm glad that obviously I've been in stuff where I can actually kind of give two fingers up to that comment. But this is the sort of savageness.
Send him your IMDb link.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that...
Yeah, I mean...
Go on, sorry.
No, go on.
I was going to say, I think there are other ways to deliver that message. Like I think a good teacher would give that. I mean, that was a horrible thing to say to an 18-year-old.
Yeah, I just don't think that there's a place for it. And also, you're paying someone money to bloody teach you how to act. So I'm like, do you know what I mean? Like, you know, you can probably, for 35 quid for an hour, scrape out a few nicer words than you'll never make in the industry. I'm literally paying you to just say, you know, give me advice. So just maybe make it a little bit nicer. But yeah, I mean, I think things like that, I've had a lot of like, you know, weird comments from different people in the industry along the years, but I just think you have to push past that. And I've kind of used that as fuel to just kind of get where I've sort of wanted to go. And obviously I'm still not necessarily where I am, you know, where I did want to be. But I think sometimes those comments are quite good for motivation.
Yeah. And also it's one person's opinion.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a fuckload of people in the industry.
This is the problem with this. I mean, the subjectiveness of this industry, like even people who are really famous actors, you know, not that I think she's shit, but some people will probably like, oh, Judi Dench is shit. But most people would say she isn't. Everyone's going to have an opinion, even about the most famous people in the world. So I think sort of pinch of salt with some of the things people say. And also someone once gave me an amazing piece of advice when I was doing theatre and I was reading reviews. And they said, why do you read reviews? I said, well, I just want to see if they think I'm good or not. She said, yeah, but if you read the good reviews, you've got to believe the bad reviews. And I just thought that is actually such good advice because it's so true. Because, it's, again, it's so subjective. So since then, I just now think, try and have that nugget of kind of remembering things are so subjective in this industry.
Completely. Absolutely. That's really good advice, actually. Just going back to, though, you said that our people in the industry don't give a shit about like the body double stuff. I personally find that really interesting. And my wife is an actor as well. And so when we go to the cinema, I watch stuff. We're the sort of people that are like, oh, look at the lighting there. Oh, no, they should have done that from a different angle. Oh, they've gone with that take over there. Okay. So if I was like, oh, that's the body double. That's the stand in hand. I'm the sort of nerd that would find that really interesting. So maybe people in the industry might not. But like, actually, for a lot of other people, I think that is actually really cool.
Yeah. I mean, I like hearing other people who've worked for, you know, different people as well and like getting all their juicy gossip. But yeah, I mean, all sort of acting side was just like, take it off your CV. We'll never sell you as that. Kind of, yeah, just really opposite. But for me, I think it sort of shows a bit of character. I don't know. For me, I was like, surely this is a good way, you know, to enter into a conversation. But no, it's just not really. And I kind of get why, because people are going to be like, well, I want to see if you can say lines. I don't care how good a back you were. But I still think it's quite interesting.
I was the best back industry, darling.
Yeah. But I was going to say, though, that there's got to be something to be said for having experience of a film set, because not all actors will have that. So you might be really good at saying lines, but you might not have ever set foot on a film set and know what it's like to work on a film set. So that's like pretty vital that you would need like some sort of experience of knowing how that works. So I think that should pay into it a bit. I know I can totally hear what you're saying with regards to, like, you know, if you're going up for jobs and stuff, maybe, you know, future casting directors and stuff might not necessarily pay attention to that. But I think just being and the fact that, you know, you turn up on time, you behaved yourself, those kind of things, definitely, as well, which I think is, at the end of the day, the few filmmakers that I know, they just like working with people that are good people and are reliable and turn up, you know. So I think those things have obviously got to be kept in the back of people's minds as well, not just that you can say some lines kind of fairly well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one time where I sort of saw the clash was when I auditioned for an acting job, like a big one, and I think I went up for two parts and I didn't get either of them. And I hadn't worked as a body double for a long time, sort of since I got my agent. I kind of obviously took it off my CV and let that one go. But I remember I just randomly got a call from production and said, we've worked with you before and we just really need someone for this job. And I was like, yeah, sure. Turned up and it was for the role that I'd auditioned for. And I was basically the back and hand and whatever they needed. And I was also the stand-in, which just meant you stand in as them to be the lighting person. Yeah. For the whole production. So I was basically just the sort of sidekick lighting girl for this job that I could have got. And that was the last job I did, because I was like, okay, yeah, that maybe it is a little bit too close to home, a little bit too painful. Kind of like sometimes I had to say the lines for the, you know, for the purpose of whatever they needed to do on the set. And it's almost like, obviously didn't say this, but it's almost like, don't give me the script. I know the lines.
Yeah, I know.
So like, that was the
This body double's amazing. She's learned the entire script.
And also there is a little bit of you where you feel a little bit like the budget version of the famous actor, like walking around dressed like Keira Knightley, but you don't look like Keira Knightley. You kind of look like the shitter version, and you're getting paid a fuck lot less. It is like
the Audi version.
If you bought Keira Knightley off Wish.
Yeah, no, literally, I felt like the budget Wish version of Keira Knightley walking around. I was like coming home and eating baked beans and jack potatoes because I was really broke, and she was getting like chauffeured.
She's going up with her 5 water bottles. Cheers, guys. See you tomorrow.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's quite funny. I mean, now it's quite funny. At the time, I was like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing because it's really highlighting that I'm not an actor and all of this stuff. But now I find it really funny, and I'm so glad I did it.
Completely. And I think everything, every sort of up and down is a story to tell later on. And, you know, I think when they happen to you, those kind of moments, like obviously you get that sort of rush of like embarrassment maybe, and you can feel your cheeks going or whatever, like whatever feelings you have when you're feeling awkward or embarrassed. But I think, you know, a couple of years later, it's a good story. You know, that was a good story for our podcast. And I think often these moments of trying to think, okay, this is crap right now, but in a few years' time, I'm going to be saying this at a dinner party or on a podcast, and we're going to be laughing about it, because I think that's a sort of good way of, I don't know, reframing it to get through that moment.
Yeah, 100%. And also, I think there's no experience, whether it's good or bad, that doesn't change you slightly as a person or build your character and all of this stuff. So I always try and tell myself that, you know, what can you take away from it, good and bad? How can you move forward? So, you know, there's lots to take away from it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we could probably all say there's been moments. I mean, I've done like book signings to nobody. Jim, I'm sure you've done stand-ups to nobody, and you know, you've done rubbish gigs and stuff. In the days doing the band and stuff, I used to play to nobody. So I think we've probably all had those moments. But like you say, they are character building, and I think also get you to realise whether you really want to do this thing. Because I think it's quite easy. It could be quite easy to walk away from doing what we're doing, but if you can sort of stick it out, take the knocks, and then you're like, actually, I do really want to do this, and I really want to do it to the 8th degree. So yeah,
I think as well the motivation was very much when I was doing the body doubling and stuff, the motivation was very much, oh, but one day I won't be the body double, I'll have a body double or whatever. That always kept me going forward. But even I remember when I became an actor, but I started getting jobs on camera and stuff, I remember like once did a job and the director's like, this is phenomenal, and like really excited. And then I turn up to the wrap party and I walk in and the director's there, and I walk up to him, and just because it happened to be the first person, he came over and he said, oh, so nice to meet you. What's your name? I said, oh, Elizabeth. And he was like, oh, so lovely that you came to the screening. Thank you so much. I really hope you enjoy it. We worked really hard on this. And I was like, oh my God, like thinking the director had kind of come over and been like, Elizabeth, so nice to see you again. Literally didn't even realize I was in the show. And I was like, God, this is so embarrassing. Like, oh my God. And then afterwards he came over and then was like, Elizabeth, so what did you think of it? Like, I think he'd obviously twigged having watched it again.
I thought,
like,
I was fucking great.
Yeah, I know. I was like, oh my God.
He wasn't so, like, you know, really looked like that person in the film. That is uncanny.
Yeah. My God.
It was almost like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. But, you know, again, I'm like, character building.
Yeah.
Keeps you humble, doesn't it?
And I'm guessing he probably felt awkward about it as well. So it was,
probably.
Both ways. Oh God. Character building. Yeah. Character building.
Exactly. All these humble moments.
Yeah, they do keep us humble. So,
they do keep us humble, yeah. I don't know if I need to be that humble, though, all the time.
Yeah, I was like, let's make this a one-off,
too much humble.
Please. Yeah. I was like, I think we'll laugh about it once, but if I have to laugh about it again, I'm just going to leave the industry.
Yeah, so true. So, tell me more about the writing, because from the bits I've seen you've done, you do some very unusual stories. Yeah. Would that be fair?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Most people say this. Or like sometimes I get editors now come to me and they're like, Elizabeth, you like weird shit. Do you want to write this? Because no one else wants to write it. But I think, so the writing started in 2020. So the acting was very, very slow. And then I've always wanted to make documentaries. It's always been a thing for me that I've wanted to do. Kind of never really knew how to start it. I'd always get really overwhelmed with the process of like, I always kind of take over and I'm like, I need to write it, direct it, present it, like do everything myself. And I was getting really overwhelmed. It's like, I don't know what to do. And I kind of like sat on it for a bit. And then in the pandemic, I was just like very stressed and very anxious because the acting just seemed even more impossible. And I'd kind of been with my agent a little while and things hadn't quite taken off in the way that I thought, which is obviously quite naive. But I think I was very excited. I'd got this big agent and I thought, oh my God, take me to Hollywood tomorrow. And I kind of was quite excited by that. And then the pandemic hit and I was like, oh fuck, like that's really not going to happen now. So I started writing down the ideas that I'd had of what I'd wanted to make into a documentary. And I made a portfolio. I made like a blog of, and just sort of started writing them as essays. And then I'd done a couple and Vice was always the company that I was like, I want to make documentaries for Vice.
Yeah.
And I was in lockdown and the sort of social distancing rule came about where you could sit in someone's garden. And my best friend lived, I think it's about 15 and a half miles from my house. And obviously you couldn't get on public transport. You couldn't do this. And I just thought, I'm going to make a mockumentary about walking to my best friend's house to have a social distance lunch and just see if it's worth walking 33 miles to see my best friend. So I got like my like, I think I literally had like the shittest earphones like plugged into my phone. I had like an iPhone 3 or like an iPhone 4 or something. And I walked like 15, it was, I think it was either six, whatever 33 divided by two is. So I walked there, which took me about five hours. I was literally walking down the motorway.
Oh my God.
Like just like an absolute nutter in some like Converses. And like walked to my friend's house, turned up at a door. And she obviously knew I was coming round. And then she literally was like, so I'm not going to lie, you took so long to come round my house, I've already eaten lunch. And I said, well, but I was like, the point of the mockumentary was that I walked to your house to have lunch in your garden, social distance, to see whether it's worth seeing my best mate for some lunch in lockdown. And she's like, well, I've eaten the lunch. So I said, well, what? I said, I've walked for 5.5 hours. What are you going to make me? And she was like, well, I've got some scrambled eggs. Do you just want some scrambled eggs? So I said, yeah, but I need sustenance. I've got to walk 5.5 hours back.
I need some calories. I'm burning here.
I need some carbohydrates.
So she was like, well, I don't have anything else. So she made me a cup of tea, one piece of toast and some scrambled eggs. And then I looked at my watch and I was like, well, I've been here for 40 minutes and I've got to walk back and it's already like 2 p.m. or something. So I was like, well, I'm going to have to go now. And she's like, oh, okay. She's like, are you sure you don't want to just like, you know, get the train or whatever, just risk it? And I was like, no, it's for Vice. It's a mockumentary. Like I have to do it. And then I walked all the way back. So 33 miles. And then I made it all together in this video and I sent it to Vice. And then I said, I really want to make documentaries. I'm like laughing, like it's so embarrassing. But I was like, really want to make documentaries for you. Here's a crazy idea I had. And the guy wrote back and he was like, Elizabeth, this is really... Like, he obviously had no clue who I was. Hadn't written a thing. I had this shitty blog, which literally had at Wix.com at the end of it because I couldn't afford the domain.
Nice.
And I was like, really want to make documentaries for Vice? Here's an idea. And he's just watching me eating scrambled eggs and walking for 10 hours. Like, and he was just like, what the fuck? He was like, this is really funny, Elizabeth, but like, no one really knows who you are. So like, we just can't put this on Vice. Like no one's going to care. But he was like, but to be fair, I'm interested in your other ideas. And at the time I'd got a couple of awful jobs. I was working as a COVID officer at Victoria Station. And I started working in a pub the day that you know, that Super Saturday where all the pubs in the UK or whatever opened in one go. And I cried all night. It was honestly like a week. And this really elderly couple, you know, everyone's masked up and everyone was like losing their minds in this pub. And it was Super Saturday and there were fights and everyone just got like absolutely hammered. People trying to have sex in their toilets, all of this stuff. And then it was like day, it was like the end of the week. And this elderly couple had come in, like literally on Zimmer frames, like obviously like completely risking their life for a pint because they'd been in their house for months. And then they were trying to tip me. And the old lady and the old man opened their purses and they poured all of their money onto the table. And it was all in one piece. And they said, we just want to tip you because you've been so nice. And I burst into tears at the table. Aww. And she was like, it's been so hard for you young folk. Like, you know, I just want to support you. And I just like sobbed. And I just said to the, pub, I said, I just can't work here. I just went home because it was just so kind of, it was all the worst parts of people on alcohol in one kind of space. And it wasn't what I wanted to do, and it was just not very nice. So I wrote back to Vice and I said, okay, yeah, fine, you don't want to hear me about scrambled eggs, but then I pitched like an actual serious piece about the fact I'd cried in this pub and what and how sort of Super Saturday was just basically fucking all of the people who work in hospitality, because it was really risky for us. We're touching like all of these glasses. Yeah. We're like going from table to table. And obviously at the time, you know, COVID was quite a scary time and all of this stuff. And then they commissioned it. And then as soon as I had that Vice byline, I just really went for it and just kept. And I sort of stopped the blog and stopped writing the stuff that I wanted to do. I mean, it happened really quickly. I was so lucky. I think I literally published like 4 essays on this blog before I got commissioned by Vice. And then I sort of didn't work. I didn't do any other essay writing on my blog. As soon as I got that byline, I was just like, right, next byline. And I just kept pitching ideas and just sending it to every editor I could possibly find on their, you know, getting their email off Twitter, just writing to literally everyone, because I didn't know anyone in journalism at all. So it was a bit of a minefield. But I think because of the acting, I'd kind of grafted so hard with just constantly messaging people, it kind of felt easier. I know that sounds mad, but it felt, I was so used to calling people, messaging people, trying to get acting jobs all the time.
Hustling.
Yeah. And then actually everyone in the acting industry just ignore me all the time. And then suddenly I had people like The Guardian writing back being like, oh, this is cool, Elizabeth. And I was like, this is insane. People are actually answering my emails. So, and then it just kind of took off, and then I could finally afford my domain name. So I bought my actual website and then just made it look a little bit nicer. And then that was 2020. And then was still doing lots of jobs. I got a big acting job that was end of 2021 into 2022. So I kind of went off. And then once I came back last year, 2022 just kind of hit the ground running with way, way more journalism. So it kind of took me a couple of years to really get into the swing of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's very impressive, as you say, not knowing anyone in the industry, but I think pitching, I think there's a parallel between pitching for articles and auditions, I think, in terms of the sort of the mindset of it. And it, you know, it's a bit of grafting going in, used to being hearing a no and just sort of cracking on. And I think for people that don't do that very often, it can be quite overwhelming, quite intense. But I wonder if the acting actually set you up for just being in the mindset for pitching.
I think as well, and this sound, I'm aware of how kind of probably shitty this sounds, but I think because acting was so the love of my life, I was so desperate to be, for people to kind of approve me in the industry, where I was just so desperate for acting jobs, that the writing was such a side hustle in my brain that it, I just cared so much less about it. And I know that sounds really bad because there's so many journalists probably like, wow, that's like all very good for her, but I want my turn. But I just think that because I didn't have that mental kind of distress every time it was a no that I did get with the acting, I found it easier to keep going with the writing.
Definitely. And I think as well, you can like, people can smell desperation sometimes, probably in an audition room, on an email, like whatever. So I think if you are slightly giving off a vibe of like, oh, look, I enjoy this, it's cool, but like, I'm not that fussed about it. Weirdly, I think that makes you more attractive.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, I hate the fact that people have told me this, but people in the acting industry were like, you are desperate, Elizabeth. Like, chill the fuck out. But like, no one's ever told me that as a writer, which says a lot. But then arguably, I've had quicker success as a writer than I have had as an actor. But then it has actually helped me as an actor, because now I've got this second career that's running parallel. Now the acting is not so much of a desperation, but I think it's hard because that normally people are desperate for a reason, and a lot of the time with acting, you know, it's quite difficult. I was on Universal Credit for a long time and things like this, so it's quite difficult when you kind of want to get yourself in a better financial position. Things are difficult and you do get desperate because you kind of feel like you've put everything into it. You're like on the breadline because you're trying to do something really important with your career, or you're trying to get your foot in the door constantly. So I did feel like I got to a stage where I was like, oh my God, I'm so desperate, because I was quite sick of being broke and not taking full-time jobs because I didn't have time to do a full-time job alongside auditioning, but then you're not getting paid for the audition. So it's like this weird catch-22. So I kind of, in a lot of ways, I want to defend the word desperate, even though no one likes anyone who's desperate. But I feel like a lot of people, there's a reason they're desperate, and actually it's more heart, there's a more heartfelt reason why people are desperate than people give people who are desperate credit for, if any of that makes sense.
Completely makes sense. Completely.
I totally get
it.
Yeah, and I've been desperate when I've been doing different things, but all like still all the time, like kind of desperate about death, like getting projects off the ground and all that kind of stuff. So I think there's nothing wrong.
It's because you care. It's because it comes from your
and
heart.
Also, I do wonder. Yeah, exactly. Because there's passion behind it. I think also I do think like some industries, and I think film industry is probably one of them, where there's probably an advantage taken of people who are a little bit desperate, like in regards to like getting you to do stuff or treating you not very well, things like that.
Yeah,
I think that's probably an area of the industry that needs to improve a little bit, and a bit more aftercare as well, when it comes to all aspects of film and television, all that kind of stuff, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, don't get me wrong. You know, I'm aware that being desperate can be quite annoying and people are like, I don't have time to deal with this or whatever. But also, I think that there are elements of the industry where communication is quite bad. And actually, a lot of it just needs a little bit more communication and things are kind of resolved quite quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I mean, God, yeah. Waiting for people to... I mean, we've talked about this. Back in the day, we had an actor, Dan Chute, on one of our first podcasts. And he... And it's something that I totally aligned with at the time, was when he said about being ignored. And as an actor, being ignored, you know, it can lead to you looking like maybe you're desperate. But you just... At the end of the day, sometimes it's easier to take the rejection than just to be ignored all the time. And I can imagine... particularly with acting and you're auditioning all the time and stuff, getting ignored is quite a regular occurrence.
Yeah, it's constant. And actually, that's what I think triggered a lot of my sort of anxieties about the industry, was just radio silence. And you put your all into stuff. And also, it's sort of the thing that I feel like doesn't get talked about enough, is an audition would come through and I'd cancel a day of work in order to do the audition because I didn't want to work in a bar or a cafe or whatever. I wanted to be the actor who maybe got the job. But obviously that then puts you under more financial strain because you've just lost 70 quid for the day. And then that puts more pressure on the fact that you haven't got an audition, and then you just don't hear back. So no one tells you whether you did good, whether you did bad, whether you were this, whether you were that. And actually it just becomes this massive cycle of chasing the dream, which becomes quite stressful. So I get there's quite a lot of things to battle with, but I think as I've got older, I've definitely chilled out a lot more and stuff like that with kind of my keenness. But then in a lot of ways I have to thank my keenness, because I don't think I would have become a journalist this quickly if I wasn't just quite keen to just kind of bash out as many ideas as humanly possible and keep going. So there's two sides to it.
Yeah, definitely. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier, every adversity shapes you and forms you into the person you are and the person you're going to be. But the journalism thing's interesting. Did you always know you could write? Has that always sort of been there? And did you always know you sort of had that sort of journalistic sort of
it's sort of instinct, isn't it, for ideas and stories?
Yeah, I think I've always been very drawn to very kind of obscure, unusual people from a really young age. I think I've always been quite nosy, so I've always naturally been quite good at asking loads of questions and finding stuff out and all of this stuff. And I think that's sort of something I was naturally doing. So I always just love chatting to people and finding really interesting people. But I don't think I ever, I know it sounds really stupid, I just kind of never considered what a journalist even does, if you know what I mean. Like, it wasn't, I would read, you know, a couple of articles or whatever and be like, oh, this is funny. But my brain would never process, oh, that's an interesting job that you'd probably be good at. And then I think film was always my medium, which is why the documentary stuff applied to me so much.
Yeah.
But because I physically couldn't do that, I think that's where I just thought, I'll just try and write it down. And then I actually found it really therapeutic to just write block essays about kind of funny, quirky stories. And actually, it was a skill I didn't really realise I'd had. I was already writing film scripts and comedy series, but I wasn't doing anything with them. I was just sort of writing it for fun. And quite often I was writing my own ideas of characters I wanted to play as an actor. Because again, I was like trying to make my own work. But I wasn't doing anything with it because I just kind of would put it to the side and get distracted by something else. But then this is a whole new medium, and I really like the fact it isn't overlapping with the acting, because it's not me writing myself a role, worrying about whether I'm going to get another acting job. It's me just saying, well, I'm just going to write about someone else for once, which is quite nice.
It's great. And I'm just looking at some, because there's some really interesting articles, and I've just got my other screen open with some of the articles. I'm going to read some of the titles of them, because I don't know if, Jim, you've heard some of these. So we've got, I didn't burp for more than 20 years. I turned my life around with Fast Lap products. I went to Disneyland every day for 8 years. I reunite people with their long lost photos. I mean, there's some amazing, I mean, I think there's some films in here that is possible. Like, tell us a bit about how you came about with some of these articles, because there's so many. Like, I mean, some of them are quite funny, but there's some poignant ones in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've literally, it's not out yet, but I've literally just come back from a nunnery, because I just lived with some nuns for a week, as you do.
Okay, can you tell us anything about that, because that sounds amazing.
I just love seeing how other people live and getting other people's viewpoints. And I think a lot of these stories are people that maybe, not all the time, but maybe a little bit dismissed by the mainstream media because they're quirky and people just think, well, that's a bit niche and a bit strange. But they're still people too with really interesting stories. And arguably, I think underdogs have more kind of grit and determination than like most people, because they are constantly getting people giving them negative backlash, but they're just again and again and again saying, no, I am who I am, I'm gonna dress really weird, no, I do believe in aliens or whatever, and they are just kind of overriding everyone's negative opinion of them every single day. And I find that absolutely exhausting, just, you know, getting over the rejections of acting. I'm like, oh, it's so knackering. And every day they step outside and someone's bullying them because they're wearing like a crazy shirt or whatever. So for me, that's the most sort of important people we should be speaking to and learning from, are the underdogs in a lot of way. And not many people kind of give them that media attention. So I thought, sort of saw a niche there, but it was also something I just enjoy talking about so much.
I completely agree. Like, Viva the underdog. I've used two languages, it doesn't really work, but yeah, I mean, I think that's it's our podcast, we do what we want. I think that's really beautiful. I think that's, yeah, and I think we probably have a little bit of the underdog in all of us. I'm talking about all three of us for what we do, but I think you can definitely learn from people that are, and I like the idea of them sort of like living their truth. And I think a lot of us mask that. I certainly do most days for fear of being judged or rejection or being ignored, or, you know, all these things that we've talked about. But I really respect people that even have to say, even people that I like politically would disagree with. And I'm thinking, the thing that's popped in my head is like Trumpers, like big sort of like MAGA people. Yeah. I'm like, well, obviously they couldn't be more polarized to what I believe in, and they're probably brainwashed in some way, but they're still, like, I guess, being true to themselves, and like that rejecting that negativity. It's an interesting, I don't know, I guess what I'm saying is, like, life is not black and white, it's gray. It's an interesting sort of like a paradox,
I guess. People like seeing people, yeah, like allowing people to be their authentic selves.
I don't believe anything they say, but like I don't know, I think I just like I like the idea of what you said about people sort of like living there. Maybe they're a bad example, but like, you know, people living their true self.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I was at school and stuff, I've dressed really quirky, and I've always been told, oh, you're really weird and you're really quirky and whatever. And then as soon as I sort of became a little bit older, I was like, oh, I don't want to be quirky. I want to be like beautiful. And kind of that completely overrode everything. And then I was kind of just became slight, not a different person, but I very much suppressed, I think, my true sort of quirky, funny self, which now comes out more in my writing. But even now, I'll get people be like, oh, you're quite quirky. But I actually find it's always said with such negativity, where actually I then feel a bit embarrassed. Oh, yeah, I'm like, oh, yeah. Am I a bit weird? Do people not like me? Or all of this stuff. So if I could just sort of champion people who are just embracing completely who they are, then I think that's quite a positive thing. And it doesn't mean I necessarily agree with everyone, but I do think that's really important that people read different viewpoints and maybe understand a little bit more about why people do things. And like, psychologically, it's so interesting. A lot of things that I sort of talk about with people about why they do things, or I don't know what, where it all comes from. Yeah. And actually it makes me realize how similar we all are.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, and you're also, yeah, you're being empathetic, and, you know, you're talking about, it's compassion at the end of the day. And I think the best journalists are empathetic and compassionate. I think they come alongside their subjects, and they're able to allow them to express themselves in a, you know, in a thoughtful way. And I think you obviously do that with the articles that you do.
Thank you. I find it quite difficult sometimes because I watch documentaries, and sometimes I feel like producers or directors kind of take the piss out of people who are quite quirky. Like, they'll put funny music behind them and whatever. Yeah. And maybe you can do a sort of comedy angle to a degree, especially if you've built up a rapport with that person, which is really important when you're writing about them. But I just don't think it's a producer or a director's job to take the piss out of someone. They should just be openly telling a story about who someone is. And I think it's where the press get a negative sort of opinion, because they're judging. And I just quite like to just try and not judge as much as possible, as much as I'd expect someone to not judge me.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. If that person's invited the comedy angle, like, you know, then I think fair enough. Yeah. But who are you to say that their life, because it's slightly different to yours, is any better or worse? Or, and I think also, if we all need a bit of weirdness. Like, if the world had no weirdness, it'd be fucking boring.
Well, what is normal?
Well,
though,
quite,
Jim?
Yeah, exactly. It's what.
Yeah,
we're all weird.
We're all a bit weird. Yeah,
yeah,
well, we are.
Yeah, it's true.
We're all limited edition.
Limited edition. That actually makes us sound a lot cooler. That's I like.
Yeah,
that
a lot. Yeah. but we are, and I think it's great actually. Yeah, to allow people to, like you say, express themselves, show their authentic selves, and tell their stories in a truthful and compassionate way, so that people can kind of acknowledge that we're not all the same, and, you know, we all do things slightly differently. And that's really great that you're doing that with your articles. Can we tell me what's been going on the back of the weird thing though, but what has been the most unusual piece that you've done, or person that you've interacted with?
So I once interviewed an alien abductee who claims that he's been abducted by aliens for over 60 years.
Wow.
And I think even that one was too quirky for anyone to commission. No one would take that on. Not a single person. And he basically claimed that he has fathered alien babies, he's been abducted for the last 60 years, his girlfriend is an alien. And
wow,
it is really hard to, because there's a lot of me as well that then questions, well, has this person got mental health problems? Should I be kind of encouraging this with my conversation and blah, blah, blah. But he's just so nice. And he also is so, you can just tell speaking to him that he definitely believes that this happened.
Yeah.
There is no element of it being kind of a hoax or being up for the press and all of these things. And it was really difficult to track him down because I think he's in his 80s. He doesn't have a computer. He doesn't have internet. He's only got a home phone. He's in America. So to track him down was so difficult. But I just absolutely loved speaking to him. I think we spoke about 2.5 hours or something. And again, I personally don't believe in aliens, but it was quite a privilege to sort of speak to someone who doesn't ever normally speak to the press. And I kind of, and in a way, it's the fact that it wasn't published by any other media outlet. Because the other thing is that you can publish a lot of stuff that then gets stolen by a documentary company or another journalist and all of this stuff. So actually, it just felt like it was my story and my moment with him. But that was definitely, that's definitely where I feel a bit nervous of, oh, you know, am I encouraging sort of mental health? Maybe if someone's not in the right sound of mind, and am I then kind of encouraging this? But a documentary has been made about him before. So, I mean, he goes to alien kind of massive alien, I don't know what they'd be called, you know, where like loads of people turn up like to a building and they speak about something. Convention?
Like an alien convention.
Yeah, wow. He just speaks at them. Right. He's like quite famous in the realm. Right. So he did feel quite a cool person to speak to. So that was really interesting. I think I interviewed some women who swear by collecting all of their period blood and using it for like face masks and plants and things
face
like
masks
that. yeah
wow.
So again, it's not something I would do, but I kind of understood them so much more from having spoken to them. And then
did they have nice skin?
Yeah, to be fair.
Wow, there you go. Beautiful. There you go.
Did they? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
I mean, my big one at the moment, which is going to be a video and a article, a long form article, is exploring the world of foot fetishes. That's been the craziest self kind of immersing experience that I've done. Even crazier than living in a nunnery, for sure. Because it's just quite obviously taboo. And I don't have a foot fetish at all. But it all started because I basically found myself unwittingly on a foot fetish website.
Oh, my God.
Someone had put me on it. And
oh, wow. What? Yeah, your feet?
Yeah.
Fuck.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
that must feel quite intrusive.
We need to unpick this.
Yeah.
So was this from a film, or was this from just someone had taken a picture of your feet and
used it?
It
was really weird.
Against your will.
It's stuff that's like, it was maybe put on my Insta. I mean, the thing is, these pictures were like literally were from when I was about, well, they it's all changed a little bit now, but when I originally found myself on it, I was older when I found it, but they were pictures from when I was like 20 or something, or 21. And I'd put a story on Instagram or something like that. And they'd basically taken it off my Instagram and just put it on this kind of foot fetish website. And then the more stuff of me goes on the internet, if I've got like even a modeling picture where I'm barefoot, or I had Getty Images take a picture of me going to an event and I had open toe shoes and they've like taken it off Getty and like put it on this fetish thing. And then the men like rank me. And I say men because the more I've delved into it, the only people who've ever messaged me are men. But so basically that led me to explore it journalistically, just to be like, what am I worth in terms of my feet? Can I make this a viable side hustle? And all, kind of, it just went so weird. I was offered $6,000 to give someone a foot job, like just insane stuff just started like unraveling, which I've been kind of writing about, but none of which I haven't done it. I didn't, I definitely said no to a foot job. But
you haven't gone... You haven't gone full Gonzo.
Yeah, I was like, I'm well. I said at the beginning I'd do anything for money, but yeah, maybe not that.
And draw the line at £6,000 for a job. Oh my God.
So that, it kind of, that was like the weirdest thing.
That is really weird. What's the legality of like...
Sorry, Jim. Was...
Is that not like, is that illegal to take people's images, obviously against their will, for that kind of thing?
I think they've said, well, it's in the public domain, so it's... It's on Getty Images, we can take it. But then I do wonder what the legality is, because you're taking something that isn't meant for fetish purposes and you're now using it for fetish purposes. It is a bit... That's something I need to... I haven't. It's not out yet and I haven't finished writing it, but that's something that I need to explore, because it just feels... But I remember one guy DM'd me. I made completely separate accounts, which were anonymous, all for feet, which I've kind of documented as part of this journalist stuff. But one guy said, oh, can I tell you a secret?
Oh, God, never a good opener.
I go to swimming pools just so I can see people's feet.
Fucking hell.
And you're just like...
Oh, my God.
Why would you tell someone that?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. So then you just think, well, then all these people... You know, walking.
It's a good, I mean, to be fair, it's a good place to go.
It's the best place to go.
You know, or the beach. I mean, those two are probably the two best places. Yeah.
And the thing is, I don't think, you know, my article is very much not fetish shaming. If you like feet, that's fine. But it's the line at which people aren't consenting to be a part of this. And that is what I found uncomfortable, was that.
Yeah.
I've got people ranking my feet, but I haven't put myself on in that situation, and that's where it's really difficult, because, you know, I don't necessarily want men. Well, this is what was happening before, but I was getting men messaging me on Instagram with requests because they'd found me on this site, but I hadn't put myself on the site, and that's all this lines were getting blurred. Yeah. So,
and even if that's not illegal, it's sort of one of those things that feels like it should be. You know what I mean? Yeah, even if I guess it isn't, depending on whatever voyeur laws or whatever. So, I don't know. Because I did, go back to journalism, I did journalism at university, so I had to do a lot of like media law and all that kind of stuff. And the laws keep changing. And I think while I was at uni, one of the voyeur laws or whatever it was had changed or something, so you have to like keep up to date with it. But I just, it's everything you're telling me about the foot thing is flagging this in me. I'm like, it feels like some law somewhere. But maybe not. I don't know.
It's got to be. I mean, the problem with me now with journalism is that everything becomes a story. It is so bad. Yeah. Everything I read, someone will tell me something funny. Someone will steal my feet pictures. And instead of being like, oh my God, that's terrible, then instantly my brain's like, well, I'm just going to write an article about it and it will be fine. And it's just like, where's the line of my own personal life? It's just everything.
Yeah, but I'm like that with stand-up as well. Like if I have a really shit day or like someone says something funny, I'm like, oh, that's good. I'm going to write that one down because that is going in my next 5 minutes. But whatever, you know, absolutely. If that's like your coping mechanism for like life, then you know it is what it is.
Well, I knew it got bad because I went to a flat viewing once and we were talking and we had a drink afterwards, me and all these new flatmates that I was maybe going to be moving in with, and one of them went, oh well, the girl, I think he said something like, oh well, the girl who lived here before, she was telling me this crazy story about she sold pictures of her feet once, and instantly my brain was like, ask who she is so that you can ask her if she can be interviewed for an article. And then you're like, no, Elizabeth, stop it. Like, you're trying to like slap yourself back down and be like, stop it. It's not work. Just ask, say, that's really interesting. Don't make it about work. It's so hard to like stop yourself.
Yeah.
It's so true. It's so true. Well, Elizabeth, honestly, it's been such a treat to talk to you. Thank you so much. It's flown by.
I know. Sorry. I feel like I have... I mean, I know the point of a podcast is to waffle on about myself because that's why you've invited me on it, but I feel a bit bad.
No, it's been amazing.
No, not at all. That's been really, really interesting. Yeah, I can't wait to read that article. It sounds absolutely fascinating. And there's definitely a documentary in there, I think.
Oh, yeah. That's my next plan, if anything crazy happens, is document it.
Is it bad that like I'm
purposes of a documentary?
Is it bad that I'm thinking, I wonder how much my feet would get? Like that there's levels.
Give
of
it a go.
There's levels of narcissism, but I don't know. I've got
dude, you might already be on there.
I've got horrendous feet. And in fact, actually, I'll share something with you guys. I don't know if this will make the edit. But there's a couple. I'm a Crystal Palace fan, as Charles is, and there's a sort of group of Palace fans on Twitter that really dislike me for some reason. I'm not quite sure what it is. But I once tweeted, literally 10 years ago, because I got a football injury, my toe went black, and I never had it before. So I tweeted, like, is anyone like a doctor? Like, what's gone? Do I need to go to like hospital or something? What I got to do?
Mate, you get you get extra for that black toe.
Weirdly, I've actually since then it's never healed properly, and I always get that same injury. It's really annoying. But like. Some these weird Palace fans don't like me. Screen grabbed it, and every now and then I see it popping up, and they're like, "Oh, it's the Jim Daly foot fetish." I'm like, well, "I was just asking for like, have I broken my toe?" It's so odd. They've like used it to take the piss, even though I think it makes them look weirder. Then,
yeah, it does.
Very
yeah.
strange.
Someone. Or several people on their camera
I've
roll on
my
their phone
feet.
Has got
yeah.
your
yeah.
phone. You've yeah, got your toe.
I think I'll explain to someone.
I mean, they're probably
why is it on there?
Why have you got that on there, mate? Oh, that's nothing.
There probably is an actual fetish, because what I did notice was smelly feet's a thing, pretty feet's a thing, ugly feet, whatever. So actually, I'm sure there's a broken toe thread, you know, that you
I could make a lot of money
with.
Then, because my big toe on my left foot yeah. is disgusting. It's absolutely horrendous. So
you
yeah,
can
probably the weirder maybe. The foot, the more potent the fetish.
Oh man, it's been an absolute joy talking to you. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Yeah,
thanks
so
much
so
for
much.
Yeah for
thank
sharing
you
your
so
story.
Much. No, thank I really you. Appreciate you inviting me.
Oh, it's been brilliant.
Elizabeth McCafferty there on the Blank podcast. What a fantastic person. I've learned a lot about the acting world, the journalism world, and the dark web. So I feel like, what more do you want to learn about in one episode? Yeah, great person. Could, as ever, could have chatted to her for absolute hours. Just a joy to chat to, really. And, you know, I think I'm definitely going to start reading a few more of her articles, because I think just not only just the subject of them, but the way she approaches them. I think it's really piqued my interest. So, yeah, someone to definitely go and search out if you want to keep life interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love kind of the sort of gonzo journalism approach, you know, where you really actually take on your subjects and get in there, get your hands dirty, as it were. Yeah. You know, that's always fascinating. That kind of, I suppose, you know, people like John Monson, Louis Farrugh, that style of journalism where you actually really immerse yourself in those people's lives for a bit. And I think that's really, really interesting. And funny enough, I just went on a TikTok the other day and she was trying to seek out the best decaf coffee. And she was trying all these different coffees in different places. And some of them were making her quite unwell. She was still like kind of going for it to find the perfect kind of decaf blend. I did message her and say, we've got a very good decaf at Backers. Yeah.
Classic. I'd love it if Backers suddenly ends up top of the list.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I love that. I love that she gets really immersive in it. And I suppose it's being like almost going method, isn't it? When you're acting, really immersing yourself in the stories. So I think that's it's always fascinating when people do that.
Absolutely. I think a lot of that comes from the acting background, yeah. of immersing yourself in subjects. So thank you, Elizabeth, for coming on. What an absolute legend. That was a lot of fun. And we're back, Giles. We're back after our Easter break. So we'll be back next week with another episode, of course. But until then, I'll be trying to avoid pollen.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, might just stay and lock myself in the cabin. I hope you have a good week.
Yeah, you need to get yourself some local honey.
I heard that from someone else. And I have tried that in the past, and I sort of keep forgetting about it. Mm. But I need to have, because I normally have like porridge in the morning because I'm trying to lose weight. So I can put a bit of honey, local honey in my porridge, might set me up for the day, actually.
Yeah, definitely do it, man. Seek it out. That's supposed to be the bee's knees.
Very good. Well, that's my week sorted. Anyway, have a good week, mate. Have a good week to all our listeners. And we'll see you again next week. And remember, Giles.
Don't get cancelled.
This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.